we can move on from hoping and wishing and to just being able to grieve.
Searchers recover two bodies from the Sitka landslide. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 20th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, scientists puzzle over the fur seal decline in the Pribilofs.
People out there have less access to that marine mammal, which they use for a food resource, so they're suffering from that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pacific University offers personalized education with real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. Details at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Search crews have recovered two bodies from the Kramer Avenue landslide in Sitka. One remains missing, but search dogs have called attention to a third location on the south side of the slide, where work focused for this afternoon. Officials hope to recover all three bodies before the heavy rains, which are predicted for Friday. KCAW's Rachel Waldholt reports.
Search crews were finally able to get to work in earnest late Wednesday and Thursday, after a period in which officials kept work on the site to a minimum out of fear of more landslides. Crews found the first body at about 7:15 Wednesday evening and recovered the second just before 1 p.m. Thursday, both on the north side of the landslide. Both bodies were first found by dogs with the Juneau-based search team, Sea Dogs. By Thursday afternoon, dogs had identified a third area where crews hoped to find the body of 62-year-old William Stortz, Sitka's building official. Stortz was inspecting drainage in the subdivision at the time of the landslide with two other men who managed to escape. Stortz and brothers Elmer and Ulysses Diaz, ages 26 and 25, had been missing since the Tuesday morning slide. Sitka Mayor Mim McConnell was at the Kramer Avenue site for most of the day Wednesday. She said it was a relief to families to have some closure.
Obviously, it's good to know what's happened to your loved one, and you know, we can move on from hoping and wishing and to just being able to grieve.
The area around Kramer Avenue remains unstable. The slide moved downhill another 2 feet overnight, and the city has posted workers at each side of the slide with air horns to signal an evacuation if any additional movement is detected. But McConnell said crews were just happy to be able to work.
I think they feel the way I do. It's a huge relief, and I know so many of the volunteers and people working have been frustrated because they couldn't do anything initially. And so it's just been a relief to be able to just get in there and get to work and get going.
Sunshine broke through for much of the day on Thursday. As the clouds lifted, it was possible to see the path of the landslide above Kramer Avenue, where it cut a swath down the hillside. A team of geologists brought in to assess the slide estimated it started about 1,400 feet up Harbor Mountain, or about 1,000 feet above Kramer Avenue, where it wiped out one home and damaged another. Searchers hope to recover all three bodies before more rain, predicted for Friday. The National Weather Service is calling for 2 to 3 inches of rain Friday night and gusty winds. But meteorologist Joel Curtis said this storm will be less intense, with a limited risk of more slides.
What's different about this event is that it's going to be spread out over much more time than the event that caused our mudslides and landslides around here.
Officials have identified at least 6 landslides around Sitka caused by Tuesday's heavy rains, including slides on the Blue Lake Road that are blocking access to Sitka's main hydroelectric dam, and washouts on the Green Lake Road on the way to the city's other dam. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Rachel Waldholtz.
Medicaid expansion is set to roll out in Alaska on September 1st. It would offer health coverage to 40,000 very low-income adults who don't have children. The lawmakers suing to stop expansion plan to ask a judge for a preliminary injunction that would prohibit the state from implementing the program before the issue is decided in court. APRN's Annie Feit has this look at what both sides will need to prove in order to make their case.
Brewster Jamison is a lawyer who handles a wide range of civil cases for the Anchorage branch of Lane Powell. He has no ties to the Medicaid expansion case, but he has a lot of experience asking for preliminary injunctions. He says to convince a judge to issue an injunction, you have to do a few things.
You have to show that you're likely to prevail on the merits, first off, and the court has to find that that there is a likelihood that you'll prevail. And then, in addition, you have to show irreparable harm and no adequate remedy at law. And it's a relatively high standard.
Irreparable harm is something money can't fix. For example, if an historic building is about to be torn down, a judge might grant an injunction to a historical society to keep the building standing temporarily until they can prove it deserves to stick around long term. If you tear it down, it can't be rebuilt exactly the same, so the damage is irreparable. Of course, the legislature's case is very different. Here's Jamison again.
So here I think that you'd probably have the legislature arguing that unless the injunction is granted, there is really no way to fix the legal quandary that they're in.
Chad Hutchison is a lawyer who works for Republican Senator John Coghill. He helped craft the case that convinced the Alaska Legislative Council they should sue the governor. But he's reluctant to go into detail on how the lawyers will prove irreparable harm if Medicaid is expanded.
Well, we have a few arguments, with all due respect, I think we'll keep them close to the vest until the court filing is going to occur.
But Hutchison will talk about the other big thing the legislature needs to convince a judge, that they're likely to win.
We believe we have a very compelling case.
The case comes down to whether the group who would benefit from Medicaid expansion is considered required or optional under the law. The governor needs the legislature to approve adding an optional population to the Medicaid program. Hutchison says the U.S. Supreme Court settled that question when it allowed states to choose whether to expand Medicaid.
If you look at the Supreme Court case, It is clear that they did not require the states to expand the Medicaid population.
Alaska's attorney general disagrees. The state declined to talk about the case. But in a letter to Senator Coghill, Attorney General Craig Richards writes, federal statute clearly lists the expansion beneficiaries in the required category. Richards says the court only struck down the penalty for not complying with Medicaid expansion. The court did not eliminate the new required category. Richard says just because there's no way to enforce the expansion requirement doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Brewster Jamison says he's really glad he's not the judge deciding the case. He's also thankful Alaska is a state with a completely independent judicial branch.
You don't want a judiciary that is made up of political cronies of either party. What you want is a judiciary made up of judges who will call balls and strikes, do the best they can to decide the issues. In Alaska, I think we're very fortunate to have a judiciary like that.
Hutchison with Coghill's office says the Legislative Council hopes to file their lawsuit in Superior Court on Monday. That will give the judge less than a week to hold a hearing in the case. The timeline is shortened by President Obama's visit because the courts won't hold hearings when he's in Anchorage on Monday, August 31st. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a technology grant promises change in Nanwalek.
We really have a lot of hope for this. I think we're truly going to be able to transform teaching at Nanwalek School.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
The
carcasses of 30 whales that have stranded along the Gulf of Alaska and the Alaska Peninsula have puzzled scientists since the first discoveries this May. And now NOAA is giving the cases unusual mortality event status. That means the stranding event is unexpected, involves a large number of marine animal deaths, and requires immediate attention. The designation gives the agency more resources for the investigation. The reason for the whale deaths is unknown, but scientists are hypothesizing that biotoxins due to an unusual warm patch of seawater may be involved. NOAA Fisheries lead marine mammal scientist Terry Rolls spoke during a media teleconference today. She says they've tested one whale out of the 30 reported.
Most of the carcasses have been not retrievable. They've been floating and or they've been stranded for a temporary period of time in inaccessible areas, and a lot of those have been moderately to severely decomposed.
They have run some tests for biotoxins, but so far they've been inconclusive. Rolls says the sample they collected tested negative for domoic acid, a toxin produced by algae that thrives in warm seawater conditions.
We still have the saxitoxin results pending, but it hasn't been a sample that's been successful for us for biotoxin testing in the past. So even though the one sample we've tested was negative, it was not the most appropriate sample to collect and test for biotoxins.
Rolls says they can't say for certain that the whales was not exposed to a biotoxin. In order to rule in or rule out possible causes of the whales' deaths, she says they need more samples. But big whales are difficult to access in order to conduct necropsies.
Trying to investigate large whale mortality events provides a lot of logistical complications in getting access to good samples, getting access safely to carcasses, and even finding a place for carcasses, if they're floating, to be towed and examined.
Roll says the next step is to put together the investigative team and pull the data. A team of scientists with the National Marine Fisheries Service is on an isolated island slightly north of the Aleutian Chain. They're researching an exploding population of fur seals on tiny Bogoslav Island. John Rotten reports from KUCB.
Northern fur seals have been declining for decades in their stronghold in the Pribilof Islands. That's a couple hundred miles to the north, but their numbers are taking off on Bogoslav. It's a mile-long island just slightly north of the rest of the Aleutian Chain and about 50 miles west of Dutch Harbor. It's a mile high as well, but only the top 300 feet of the volcanic cone rise above the Bering Sea. And fur seals seem to love it. Mike Williams of Anchorage is part of the team of Bogoslav researchers with the National Marine Fisheries Service.
We first saw breeding animals there in the 80s, and now we're looking at a large portion of the Alaska population now is on Bogoslav, where there weren't any in the 80s.
Most of the world population of northern fur seals breeds in the Pribilof Islands. That's been true for centuries. Russian navigator Gavril Pribilof even located the islands in 1786 by following the barks of fur seals through the fog. Sounds of a seal rookery on St. Paul Island. The recording's part of an audio archive from Cornell University. Commercial hunting of fur seals stopped in the 1980s, but the big St. Paul population has kept on falling.
We're concerned about the decline, so we want to keep track of what's happening with this increasing population versus the populations in the Pribilofs and be able to at least have some idea of how their populations are moving.
Any idea why Bogoslav appears to be increasing?
That's the million-dollar question. I wish we knew.
A half million or more seals haul out onto the Pribilofs each summer. Many of the seals head down into the Aleutians at other times of the year. Scientist Bruce Wright with the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association says nobody knows why the Pribilof populations keep plummeting. Only a small subsistence harvest of about 2,000 animals a year is taken. Wright says declining populations have made getting food harder in the Pribilofs.
People out there have less access to that marine mammal, which they use for a food resource, so they're suffering from that.
Scientists have lots of educated guesses, but few answers about the decline, from the impacts of fisheries to climate change. Wright has a hypothesis of his own, toxic food. Blooms of harmful algae can cover the ocean in a living layer of toxic muck. This year has one of the largest harmful algae blooms on record in the North Pacific. It reaches all the way to the Aleutian Islands. The small fish that fur seals eat, like sand lance, can accumulate toxins from the algae. Wright wants to know if the Pribilof seals have been getting doses of poison when they feed in the Aleutians.
But now we have this population of Bogusov in the Aleutian Islands, and I'm really interested to find out where those fur seals are feeding. If they're feeding in the Aleutian Islands, then that would help reject this hypothesis. But maybe they're feeding out on the continental shelf of the Bering Sea, and they're not at risk of, at least right now, of encountering toxic sand lance.
Algae grow faster when the ocean is warmer. Wright says with warming ocean temperatures, it's only a matter of time before we see big algae blooms in the Bering Sea and Arctic Ocean, like we've seen in the North Pacific this year. The fur seal researchers will be counting pups and females and putting satellite tags on a few of them to see where Bogusov seals get their meals. In Unalaska, I'm John Ryan.
Flint Hills continues to push for a less stringent standard for removal of a spilled chemical from groundwater at the company's shuttered North Pole refinery. As KUIC's Dan Bross reports, removal of the industrial solvent sulfalane is costing the refinery a lot of money, and opinions differ on how clean groundwater really needs to be.
Historic sulfalane spills at the refinery spread to groundwater, and Flint Hills is trying to purge the chemical from the water according to a state cleanup plan. The state set the cleanup standard at 15 parts per billion while it awaits results of a two-year federal study on health effects of drinking low concentrations of the chemical. Flint Hills has asked the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation to consider upping the standard to 362 parts per billion, a level Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says is backed by a state-sanctioned review.
They went ahead and convened that panel of experts last fall at the University of Alaska and brought them in, and they determined with consideration of being safe and putting in some parameters to take care of uncertainty that Flint Hills was on the right track. So we ask, we've been waiting for the commissioner to set an ACL, and he punted on that and decided that he was going to have more studies done.
Flint Hills has filed a request seeking an adjudicatory hearing on the cleanup standard. Cook says it costs Flint Hills significantly more money to meet the more stringent standard, but stresses that the company continues to adhere to it.
Even though we have this appeal, that doesn't mean we've stopped doing anything. We're going to continue to take care of the property owners as we always have and continue to work on our on-site cleanup.
The body of research on sulfalane is small relative to what's known about effects of other industrial contaminants. And DEC Spill Prevention and Response Director Kristen Ryan points to that uncertainty in erring on the cautious side until the study using testing on animals is completed.
Since the individuals that are going to be exposed to sulfalane in North Pole will be drinking it, perhaps their entire life if they are using their well water, we wanted to make sure we understood what those long-term effects were going to be before we decided what a safe level for consumption is.
Ryan stresses that the water quality standard Flint Hills is contesting is for groundwater cleanup on refinery property.
But there is a substantial flow of groundwater in that area, and it's shallow and deep. And so they are required under the approved on-site cleanup plan, which is done, to pull up any water that's leaving the refinery and run it through a charcoal filter, which is removing the sulfalane, and then reinject it back into the groundwater table.
The on-site contamination is the source of pollution that spread to wells on hundreds of surrounding properties in North Pole, where about 1,500 people live. Flint Hills has been providing affected residents with drinking water alternatives, including bulk water deliveries and installation of well water filtration systems, since the contamination was first discovered off-site in 2009. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Alaska Pacific University is still accepting applications for the fall 2015 semester for their Master of Business Administration program. APU offers personalized education grounded in hands-on real-world experiences to prepare graduates to be leaders in their communities. More at 1-800-ALASKA-U or alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
For students and teachers in the village of Nanwalek, this academic year will likely be very different from years past. They are the recipients of a technology grant from Apple that could change the face of education in the village. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Sally Ash is sitting in her large classroom at Nanwalik School.
Hello, my name is Sally Ash. I grew up in Nanwalik. I am from Nanwalik, and my dad's name is Sargis Kvasnikov, and my mother's name is Juanita Melsheimer.
She's a Sukhtun language teacher here.
I think it gives them a background of who they are, where they come from, and the knowledge that's sitting right here where they're living, you know, it enriches their life as they get older too. You know, how to live and get along in the world, but do it the right way.
Because language is intertwined with culture and values.
There's a lot of studies being done that if you know more than one language, it makes you smarter. And not only if a speaker wants to go outside of Nanwalik or, you know, somewhere else and become a rocket scientist, they could, you know, they could. Or if they want to stay home and be a subsistence or help out with the fish here, or, you know, things like that, they could. They have a choice, you know, so they're not stuck with one thing.
Like all of the teachers in the school, for years she's made do with aging instructional materials like her yellowing dog-eared dictionary and too few copies of important textbooks. But now one wall of her classroom is filled with a smart board, an interactive piece of technology that takes the place of the traditional chalkboard.
I was so, like, scared when we first got it. I was like, how is it going to benefit, you know, in my class? How am I going to use it?
Apple is not leaving things to chance.
That's school principal Nancy Klein. She was contacted by Apple last year to apply for the special grant program. Apple started the program to bring technology into schools in low-income areas in response to President Obama's Connect Ed initiative. Nanwalik was the only school selected in the state of Alaska and one of only 114 total in the country. As a result, it's receiving an iPad for each one of its 80 students and every teacher and aide. In addition, all teachers are getting MacBooks. There are now Apple TVs in every instructional area, not just classrooms, an iMac for the front desk, storage carts for the students' pads, and charging stations for every room.
They've given us 17 days of professional development. They've given us 3 years of support. They've had team after team come out to test the infrastructure and work with us to develop a strategic plan so that it really will be successful for our instruction.
They've also provided funding for teachers to purchase apps specific to their classes and subject areas. Klein says that's the key. It's about more than just technology. It's about changing the whole learning environment.
We really have a lot of hope for this with the students and the parents and the community being partners. I think we're truly going to be able to transform teaching at Nanwalik School.
Sally Ash already has big plans for her students and their new gadgets this year, both in the classroom and in the village, starting with the old books.
The pages are really torn and well-used books and that we want to put on the board so the kids will be able to see and we'll be able to record our elders. And we could take our iPad out and we'll take pictures of things, bring them back, identify them, write the name, you know, and that sounds exciting to me too.
She also wants to set up regional speaking sessions with other schools in the Prince William Sound area using a video program.
It really makes me happy. I get really emotional because it's one of my passions is that the kids, you know, I want them to learn Sukhtun, and to hear them is just a joy to my ears and heart. Thank you very much, Rihanna.
I just think this is an opportunity for these kids to grow, and one of the things that I'm really hoping that it does is that they just will want to come to school and be engaged and be partners in this learning, and the attendance will grow. And we're just totally launched for one of the most fabulous years you can even imagine.
And like Sally Ash, Principal Klein says she thinks this grant could have lasting benefits for the entire community far into the future. In Nanwalik, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Everyone has a story to tell, but it may not be the story you'd expect. This summer, an Anchorage nonprofit called StoryWorks focused on helping students who arrived in the state as refugees tell their stories. Last week, I joined them and their mentor as they lounged on couches at UAA, telling each other about their lives.
You learned something from that day?
Yeah.
Olive Mtoni interjected in Swahili, translating for her new friend, Faraha Sefania. Both girls are originally from the Congo, but Mtoni's family fled the war-torn nation to Rwanda before she was born. Sefania's went to Mozambique. They met for the first time at East High in Anchorage late last year. But that's not the story Sefania has chosen to share. She's talking about a time when she was 12 years old and playing soccer with her friends back in Mozambique. Her little sister calls her to come and eat, and she refuses to go. When she finally heads home, 2 hours later, the food is gone. Her sister laughs because she's received extra, and her mother admonishes her. If you like soccer so much, then you can eat it. Sefani says she learned to listen to her mother. So why tell this story? She just thought of it when chatting, and that's the whole point. Stories are just moments to help people understand each other. That's why 11-year-old Khalil Lades participated in the program. He was born in Anchorage, but he loves storytelling and wanted to learn about the other kids.
A lot of the kids have stories to tell, so it's like this is like a big camp for them because they have big stories from their country that they told here, so it's pretty big for me to come here.
Adace learned about a girl who climbed a tree, was distracted by a monkey, and ended up in the hospital getting shards of wood pulled from her arm. A boy told about the disappointment of leaving home for a cold place, but eventually making new friends. Jessica Kovarek, the program director of Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services, says these stories can help the community understand people from other nations.
We really wanted to give the youth an opportunity to have some voice and to learn to tell their stories and recognize how powerful their stories are and how much they have to share with the community.
Iklas Dubed shares the story of her first bee sting just a month ago.
Then I ran around. I was out of breath. So I was all like this, it hurts. Then the bee was still on my hijab, so I took it off.
The sting taught her what goes around comes around. She laughed at other kids who were stung, then was hurt herself. But telling the story taught her.
Don't be scared to tell other people that you don't know.
Do you feel more brave now?
Kind of.
Race helps resettle about 100 to 140 refugees in Anchorage each year. StoryWorks started in 2014 and teaches high schoolers from around the community to find their voices. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, John Ryan in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, connecting Alaska's business travelers across the state for more than 50 years. Find more at flyraven.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.